This is sound card two of an interview between Angelo Dell and Alison McDougall at the State Library of South Australia on Wednesday, the 12th of December 2007. Now, we've been talking about that horrifying time for you when the militia came through your village. And you talked about hiding and having the horsemen come very close to you.
Yes.
Tell me, can you remember what was going through your mind at that time?
Yes, I was thinking two things. One was to run again, and two, if I did, they would see me. And I was telling myself, I better hide here. If they come and get me, that's fine, but I think this place is not, they cannot see me because it's too dark inside this big tree bush. So I briefly stayed down, laying, and just they come pass by and they are shouting, come out, we are seeing you, come out, come out. And I thought that they were really just want to let people come out while they are not really looking at you. So I thought, if they are looking at me, they will come and get me. So I better stay down. Then after all, they shout and pass.
How long were you there hiding?
I hid there for 5 hours in the same place, no movement. I just lay down and forward, my chest downward and my head, and lay down still for at least 5 hours, because I thought if I move, and maybe I will touch a tree or something different that would really make a sound and they would see me where I am. And I was to stay there until when I don't hear anything. And that time was around 4 p.m. That's when I really realized that the sun is really going down and the bush become dark and there are wild animals in the bush. So it was another scary sort of thing. So I thought, yes, now I'm hiding here, but the sun is going down. So what can I do? I better, maybe these people, they are gone. So I have to wake up and keep going and hiding. So I keep going in between the bush and between the big tree. I usually attach myself to a tree and look very carefully on the road. And I see nothing, then I go on, so hiding. And I don't go through the road. I usually walk along the roadside to avoid any further attack or captured. Or I want to make sure that the road was clear, and I walk, beside the road till I came home.
And what happened when you came home?
I saw people were crying and everybody was gathering there. Some people, they lost their mothers, dad and children. Some people lost their husband. Some people lost their children, some people lost their grandfathers, like myself. And because the worst thing that they were been alive, it make it even worse, because people see that this war really is not a war that is between one country. If it is, why people are been alive? Why they don't capture them and take them to prison? Or but burning human being alive, including children, they think that there was no any forgiveness between the two sides of the country. The Christian thought that Muslim government was very evil, and doing that does not contrast with the Bible. So they become shouting Alleluia, and they try to, you know, to find ways for, you know, for next attacks, if it happened, either to kill old men rather than destroying the whole village. So the men in the village or in the town were gatherings, and they are trying to buy guns and try to protect these when there is another attack. So, and that is how they thought, because they said this would be continuing, so we better, we the men, buy guns and protect the village rather than seeing people are being burned alive and children are killed. So we are not worthy living with while we are not protecting our families. These were the men who are talking, like, you know, decisions, and they have to make a big decision, including my dad. So they have to, you know, to see a way that they can gather money and send someone to shut and buy guns from there.
And how long was it before you could find your parents?
It was not long. After I came back, it's just a matter of some hours. So after I came back, I found them at home. And they were surprised me, you know, turning up. They thought that I was among the people who were banned. They didn't know that I was, I have run and I hide, you know. And when they saw me, they were really happy, but not really happy, because the situation was already messed up. So they are happy that they see me, but they are not happy because they lost other family members. So they just hugged me, and they're still crying. It was, I can't tell that they were happy. They are, I know in my heart they are happy to see me, but also they are being touched by the other devastating thing that is, you know, in front of them, you know.
And so you stayed on for 3 more months.
Yes.
And then you made this decision to run away and join the army?
Yes.
Can you tell me what happened on the day that you decided to do that?
On the day I decided to do this, because I asked my dad before, in between these 3 months, what to do, and I told him I will join the army, and he said, no, you can't do it because you are too young, and, you know, and walking from here to Ethiopia, you would encounter a lot of things on the way. There's big rivers that you cannot, you know, swim, or you cannot cross, and because of the reason you can't go. Secondly, there are a lot of things on the way, like wild animals, and the distance is almost 3 months. That is what he told me, because he's been in the Anyanyawan, which is the movement that signed peace in 72. He told me, no, you can't do it because it is too risky for a young person like you. So that's when I decided, okay. He's telling me not to, and staying here is one of the two, either to be caught a slave or to be killed. So I better go. So the day I left, only the person that I told her is my mom. I said, Mom, I know you love me, and I know that I am one of your favorite son, but I am going because this would not end. As you see, everybody is killed, and next time maybe it will be my turn or you guys' turn. And if you are killed, then I would remain orphan, and I wouldn't live a good life. So I better go and join the army and be trained. And my mother was saying, look, my son, I'm very happy that you have that bravery, but you are too young to do anything. If you want, I can go with you, with the whole family, to Ethiopia. And I said, no, I don't need all the family to go to Ethiopia. I will go myself. And therefore, I told her to prepare me some things for my going, and she did. And the day I steal myself, I took things after my dad was in the other stepmother's house. So that night I steal myself, and I went in the morning when he came home, he asked me, and Mom said, I don't know, he was here, he was sleeping in the house before, so I don't know where he went. And later on, when I reached to the base of the rebels, so I told them to inform my dad that I'm alive and I'm going to be trained to be a Shell soldier, and I will fight the northern government. So that's when he heard I was still in the region, but I wasn't, with the army, and he didn't have any, anything to do again, because it was very, very critical movement to think that if he can come, it means the family would remain alone. So he then wrote a letter saying that to the person who was responsible, that take care of my son, and I hope he would be, if all the family happened to be killed, he would be the seat of my family that would remain. If he's happened to be the one who is killed, then the rest of his brothers here and sisters might remain in the family. So I just want to say that take care of him. And I know he's one of the bravest son that I have in the family. I know he's responsible and he's very social. He can live with anybody, even though he don't know them. I think he would make it to the top if he's alive. That is his comment in the letter. And so from there, we start our journey.
So tell me, how did you get to the base?
The base was based in the in a place called Nyamlel. Just in that place, the rebel, Southern Sudanese rebel, who went to Ethiopia and they were trained, they had been armed, they came and they want to fight the Arabs. And because they were very few, they don't really face the big, massive of the army from militias that was trained. There are so many. So sometimes they fight, sometimes they hide. And that's where, that's the base that I joined ahead of them. And I joined them, and that's when the first lieutenant told me, he's one of the area's son, he told me that, yeah, you can stay here for a few days and then you will be escorted to Ethiopia. But he gave us 4 armed people with guns, and he said that these people will escort you to Ethiopia.
How far was the base from your village?
It's about 4 hours walk to the base.
And how did you feel walking there? Was that dangerous?
Well, it was not that dangerous. But it was because that we usually walk hiding, We used to work at night, and that is how I did it with others, village kids. So we work at night to go to the base, because if we work on the daytime, it might be that we are a target. We can be seen by militias, and maybe they will, you know, attack us. So we used night sort of work, and also it also served for not having water. It will be good to work at night time.
And what did the commanders say to you when you arrived at the base?
They said that it is, you are here because of the causes of the war, and we know many of you are still young. Probably you will be trained and taught how to shoot in Ethiopia when you reach there. And maybe some of you will grow up to be teenagers, and therefore you will make a good army to liberate your country. And because you guys, you have voluntarily come to join SPLM, SPLA, we don't need children, but if you are voluntary yourself to say, I would save for the cause of Southern Sudan, we accept you, we don't deny anybody, because that is what you want. But we will make sure that you are kept in a safe pen, unless the whole army of SPLM are not existing. If they are, you guys cannot go in front line.
And so you had several days there?
Yes, I got about 2 weeks there for the arrangement to go on, because going from the base to Ethiopia, it would be a 3-month walk. So they were looking for gathering some kettles to go with us, because each and every time we have to kill one kettle for consumption of a week, and if we kill one, we will carry those meats with us and walking. And these four army personnel would be escorting us, so because there are lions on the road and in the bush, and there's a lot of things, other wild animals, and that's why they select these four guys to escort us to Ethiopia.
How many of there were you in the group?
I can remember we were not less than 800, and that 800 include big guys, real men that were older men and medium men, and young boys like myself and other teenagers. And my group were the youngest, because it was ranging from 8 years to 9 and 10. We were kept alone. We were not mixed with these big people. We were kept alone, and we were cared for.
In what way?
Well, we would not cook. They would find some woman to cook for us, and what we only do is to eat, and then we will be escorted to a place where because these four personnel, army personnel, they were mainly guiding these young people, not to really, if somebody is walking and is very tired and can't walk, they would get an older person, maybe 3 or 4, to carry him or her to, you know, in the journey. So, because it happened that many of the children get very tired and they don't want to work no more, and they have to be carried.
Were there girls as well as boys?
No, there wasn't girls in that time, because it was the start of such a move to take on, and there were no girls in that period of time that we went to Ethiopia.
So describe a typical night's walking for me.
Well, when we walk at night, you are expecting a lot of things. You know, it is a bushy road, and you will walk there at night. Some, as I told you, wild animals are there. Despite having four army personnel, they weren't enough to protect each and every person because the number was big. We go by line, one army in the front, one army personnel in the middle, and the other one in the middle, the other one in the back. Despite all this, a lion can grab one kid here and disappear with it. That's it. And it happened since we left. It happened several times. But what you have is that you pray that it won't happen to you. That is the trust only, because each and every person is scared. You walk quietly, and despite being quiet also, it doesn't help, because lion is just there, and you know it walk at night, and because we don't prefer the daytime, because the Sudan government would bomb us if they see us walking on that in the day. And that's such a big number of people. They know that people were going to Ethiopia to join the army and come and fight. So in the daytime, they go around with their Antonov and helicopters to oversee Southern Sudan, who is walking to go to Ethiopia. So that's why we walk at night, and despite that, still there is a risk of animals.
And you said it took you 3 months because you came from the western part of Sudan, and yep. Then you had to, and Ethiopia was to the east.
Yep.
Yeah. So what happened when you reached the Ethiopian border?
When we reached Ethiopian border, we were welcomed by Ethiopian, and from there we were taken to a refugee camp. And the army personnel, those who were escorting us, they went to their base in Ethiopia, and we were organized in a group. A group consists of 1,000 young children. They call it Red Army, or they call it child soldiers. And we were kept there for about 6 months. Later on, there are a lot of problems. In the first place, we couldn't get enough food. It was very critical. You can see human being walking as a skeleton, because there is no, you know, there is no meat in the body. Actually, it is really somebody's stable. It's almost to die, and likewise to others people, it seems the same. And Ethiopian government, because it was very critical, they couldn't report us to the UN until when they did. That's when the rescue of Russian, the United Nations and others organization came in and visited us in the camp, and they brought food. And from there, we start and, you know, to live a life. But before that, you know, there was no plate. There's no anything at all. If you see a piece of corn down in, on the floor, you might pick up that piece of cont and, you know, go around on the street and try to find those cones and make them, if they are about half a cup, then you are lucky that that is going to be your meal for maybe 4 days, 5 days before you get another one. So it was a very critical time, and the only way we could is just go and pitch. Go pitching was the only way to survive, and that is when the rescue came. And after the rescue came, there was only food, but there is no plate, cups, and other things. So we boiled this corn. We don't have grinding mills. We boil the corn and the beans together, and that's how we start for 3 months, living on that, just boil them, and that's the food. And because we didn't have that thing before, and we have to put down the carton or anything, and then we will put the food on that carton and eat it.
Did you have any shelter?
No shelter. People sleep under trees. We sleep under the trees, and that's the shelter until the United Nations start to bring in the tents. And those tents were not enough for this. There were about 14,000 children. 14,000 of them. The United Nations was not able to provide each child, or maybe two or three, with one tent. So they tried to put, you know, very small tent. They tried to put 5, 6 people, despite all those, you know. We have to decide, and after we get our strength back, we have to go in the bush and cut the trees and try to make a house which is more bigger. And we build it with grass and the mud under. So that is how we try to establish ourselves, to replace those tents, because they were too hot. And so, and that's how we start to live. And
was it cold at night?
It is very cold at night. When people go freezing, really, they are. Ethiopia is very cold, and that is totally different to, you know, to Southern Sudan. It was a little bit colder than the south. So.
And you would have had nothing for protection at night?
Nothing for protection at night. There's nothing at all. Even we got a lot of problems. We have to make a big security at night. People would be selected in different places to guide the whole 12,000 children. They go, you know, people were around this camp, so that the animals or anything cannot get in the camp. Because if it does, it means that it's a disaster, because these children, they were all frightened, and if they hear that there's lion in here, everybody will be running, and then it will be a disaster. So we have this system that we have to get these people to guide the children. And they have got no gun, just only they have got this... they have got these sort of stick, and that's it. And because they shout when they see something, they shout, and they, you know, the lion will go back, or the hyena. So that's how.
And were you ever on patrol?
No, I was not on patrol because I was made the head of one group, which is consists of 1,000 people. I'm the responsible person for that group. And
you were 10 years old at the time?
Yes, I was 10. And I have to really make sure that each and every person get something to eat, and make sure that each and every person has got a blanket after the United Nations has brought those things. So I have to be involved with distributions of those things, and I have to have the list in my hand to know each and every person.
How did you organize it then?
When they brought this item, non-food item, for example, cooking materials and blanket. We sit down with the logistics from Ethiopian guy who is working with the United Nations. So, and we give them the list, and we will be given the number that is supposed to be given to the to one group, and I have to take that, and I have to call these young people to carry those things, tear the you know the pile of blanket, and then we carry pieces to the group, and then we will put them together, and then I will start to tell my logistics. I have my logistic too, to tell him to call the names, and then they will be distributing according to subsection within that group, and then from that subsections, they will distribute them also to the row, and that row it might consist of 50 people. So it goes like that. That's the responsibility I was having, and I have to make sure everything was done appropriately.
Why do you think you were chosen to be in charge of
that? One reason is that they believe that I can deliver a good leadership style, and also I could write a little bit of Arabic and a little bit of English. I could call names of the people. So many people didn't have that sort of ability. So I think that was mainly the reason they have chosen me. And my social background also, I usually embrace everybody to have at least a voice. And so I think that's why they have chose me to be one of the leaders.
Was it known that you were the son of a chief?
People know, yes. Mm. People know that. And I didn't want to use that as a way to get, you know, to the responsibility, because in the first place I was not prepared to be responsible for children without their mothers and their fathers. And they are all my age mate. And to be responsible, you have to govern them in an army way, not by civilian way. Every evening they have to attend a parade, and they have to sing a song. And if somebody refuses not to do a duty, and you have to at least make a judgment in the army ways, you know, to tell them to do it. If they refuse, they will be beaten, and for the disciplinary, so that they can do, because no one will do to one another unless they cooperate to, you know, to help each other. It's a duty that one person can do a duty for 50 people today, or two of those people will be cooking for 50 people, and tomorrow is some other people, 10. And if it's your 10 and you don't cook, it means that you will be really given punishment to obey your duty and do your duty. It was really very tough situation. It's quite different to my father role, and yes, it was a very challenge.
And who would do the punishment?
Well, there is the sergeants, because somebody who is the head of those 50 people, they call it sergeant. Sergeant will take on the responsibility to choose people within as a police, maybe 3 or 4 as a policeman, and, you know, he will deliver his judgment and say, you know, give him 5 lashes, 6 lashes for disciplinary, and that's how it is. And then if it is a difficult task, it come to my my table, and I will decide what to do on that. If it is a simple problem, I wouldn't put somebody in prison, because there is a prison that somebody can stay there in a week or 2 weeks. But if it is a simple reason, I can just advise them and tell them to respect their leaders and goes back to their, to their section, and that's how best I could do, because I don't encourage these young people to stay in prison, that they cannot move for 2 weeks or 1 week. That's very hard for me, even imagining that to happen. So I usually deliver my judgment based on, on humanity basis, because I didn't want to see, I know how hard it was walking that distance and come here, and then again you will be mistreated by one person, which is among you. So it was those things that I was really thinking of were not worthy doing. So, but there is no way out. We have to talk, try to counsel them. Some people were really thinking, wow, I choose wrong to come here. I decide wrong, so I have to go back. So I was involved with counseling of people, really telling them, all of us here, we love our mothers and our fathers. You should be, should be strong and keep on. Maybe later on you will be the person that people would depend on. Maybe you are the only person that you have survived. You never know, since we left home, we don't know how many people are killed now. So you have to bear with it. You have, maybe next year it will be another thing altogether. You will be somewhere. You will be going to school. I was really trying to get them to understand and face the reality with telling them some sort of promises that tomorrow it wouldn't be like this. Maybe in 5 years' time, you would be speaking English, you will be doing this and you will be doing that. And sometimes it worked out well. Sometimes they believe me, sometimes I think, wow, why is he telling us this? If it's going to happen like this, I mean, it will be good, but if it is the other way around, we don't know. But where does he get his information, and he's here with us? It's because maybe he talked in the radio, maybe he got this information from the head top person, maybe, And I give them this hope because it's the only way to encourage them to deal with the situation at the time. So I have to be a counselor, a leader, and that's how I do best in my those days.
So the training that you had with your father from such a young age
really came into its own. It has delivered the leadership that was unexpected. I didn't expect that I would be a leader of young people without advisors that are older than I do. And I was really, try to calm down, because I resume myself as a leader, as brothers to them, as everything to them. So if I do things wrong, everything will go wrong. So I have to, and also I usually meet with other leaders when they have difficult times, and we sit together and tell them, look, this is how it's done, and you guys, you have to be like this. And so that when they go to their posts, they would really deliver the kind of leadership that people would deserve.
Were the sergeants children?
Yeah, they are. They are. Some of them, they might be older than me, but they are still the same age as 13, 14, and so.
So you were not big enough to carry a rifle when you were 10?
Yes.
So what role did you take on?
Yes, after we stayed there and everything was okay, we were taken to the training camp for, they call it a disciplinary training camp, and that involved guns, and you have to to be trained for 3 months, and then later on 4 months you go for exercise of shooting and in the bush, and then you will be released to go to front line, or you be given some other tasks to do. That is when I play, you know, I couldn't really manage to carry AK-47, not only me, likewise to my colleagues. They were too young to bear this heavy AK-47 guns. So some of my colleagues were returned to the camp, and some of them who were about 15 and 16, they were taken to front line.
Where was the front line?
The front line was, you go back to southern Sudan. People were fighting in the areas of Nuba Mountain. People were fighting in the areas of Kafoita. People were fighting in Juba. People were fighting in the areas of Bor and Wau, Awil, Malakan. It depends where you are sent to, because they were all front line in those areas in southern Sudan. So some of my friends were scattered all over to different battalions. They were distributed to different battalions because, you know, they have to be integrated to the older army so that they can fight within those experienced army. And that's when I was given a role to be trained, and I was in charge of wounded people, and I was in the process of training to be a radio operator, and so that I can operate within the headquarters, and certainly we were really in trouble with the Ethiopian government that was overthrown, and I have to take all the wounded people, so I have to get a truck and take the wounded to a safe place, and that role include the civilians, it's not only include the refugees, women and children. Those whose husbands are in the front line, they were left alone. And that role, I really think I made a difference, because I have to go back in front line where there is a battle between Ethiopian Eritrea armed forces that were really, you know, capturing Ethiopia. They were shooting at us while we are running back to southern Sudan. And I have to go back there and get wounded people and get women who cannot make it to run very fast because they got children in their hand. They can't do anything. They just cry. I have to get them in the trucks, and then I take them to a distance of maybe 1 hour, and then put them down there and come back again and get another lot. And a lot of other trucks were there because, you know, we got many trucks as we could from the United Nations, because United Nations, they left this truck, and we have to use them. We got drivers, and we have to use them to ship these people out of here, out of the camp.
So the government in Ethiopia changed.
Yes.
And they were no longer sympathetic to Sudanese refugees?
It was the coming rebel group, which were not allies to Sudanese refugees or to Sudanese army who were based in Ethiopia. Because there was a relationship between southern Sudan and Ethiopian government, which was headed by Magisto Ali Mariam. And these people who were rebels, they were based in Sudan, in northern Khartoum. So when they were fighting Ethiopia, we, the Southern Sudan, we didn't support them. So when they captured Ethiopia, we were enemies to them. So it's the other way around. So they have to fight us. And after all, they were saying that they usually bring a letter and say, you have to leave Ethiopian borders. And people were packing to go, and then they just came suddenly, and they were told that there were a lot of guns in the store, and this Sudanese army rebels, SPLM, will take those guns, so you go and, take those guns from them. And that's why they attack us, and we were surprised. We received a letter to leave, and just in a few days later, it was just attack, And that's how it happened.
So where were you based then when you were doing your retrieval work? We're looking at a map at the moment. You were still based inside Ethiopia, or just...
Yeah, we were still based inside Ethiopia. We were based here. That's where we were based.
That's close to...
Close to Sudan. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's where we were based.
So then you would have to go in the truck out into Sudan.
Yes, we have to go in the trucks, and we were not really trying to go to Sudan here. We were trying to come between the borders, trying to find a way to take these refugees to a safe place, because Southern Sudan, there is war, and because it was just that war that people are really fighting in this area, so we have to go through the borders here between Ethiopia and Sudan to get to Kenya.
Ah, yes.
To take these refugees to Kenya, so it was a big task. So we have to flee everybody to Fashala here in Southern Sudan. Mm-hmm. Then from this place, some of the refugees were taken by plane to Lokshokyo. Some walk from Peshala to Kafoita.
In Kenya?
No.
No?
In Sudan.
Mm-hmm. Again, that's a long distance, isn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that was going down inside Sudan, following the Ethiopian border, but heading down towards Kenya.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, that's now the Kenyan border was near, so people were to travel from here to there. That's where there was Lokshokyo.
Mm-hmm. And that was another refugee camp?
That was another refugee camp that became Kakuma refugee camp.
So how many years were you doing this rescue work?
It's been 1 year and 8 months. 1 year and 8 months. Because I have to come to Peshala, from Peshala to Kafoita, and then from Kafoita, I have to transport people to Lokshokyo, which is Kenya. And then from Lokshokyo, there the United Nations took responsibility, and it brought their truck and took them to Kakuma, where the camp was based. And
did you ever have to use your rifle?
Yes, I used my rifle several times, and my pistol, and But I didn't use it to fight the enemy because I was responsible for things. But I was ready to, if I'm attacked, I will fight. But I didn't. I wasn't attacked. So I usually go in the front line, get the wounded people, get out and send people in when I'm near to the place and get these things, get people out. And I have used my pistol for several things. Some of my youngest soldiers, they were refusing not to go back to front line, so I have to, you know, I have to punish them for not going back. And by doing that, some of them were trying to scare me, you know, pulling their gun out and try to say, we don't want to obey you. And I have to, you know, I have to bear with that. And I have my gun, so they know that I have my gun, but I prefer, you know, regulation or them to obey the rules. And I will use some other people to catch them and, you know, be brought to the table and discuss it. And if they say no, I will finish them. And then later on, there will be a consensus to, because we were doing right thing. I believe I was doing the right things to get people out, and that's my responsibility. And I was in the command of that. So, but I know how risky it was for them to say no. I know, but there's no way out. I have to force them to go.
Were they threatening to shoot you?
Yeah, that's likely in the army. It's something by words. But they usually think twice, when I shoot him, what will happen to me? Because he's the one in charge, so I will be killed too. So they have to think twice before they, you know, they just pull the bullet and let it go. But they just threaten me to, you know, to be scared. That's what they are trying to scare me. But
you were able to negotiate?
Yep, I'm able to negotiate. I don't even try to remove my gun. I don't remove my gun because I have to negotiate with them and tell them, look, it is our cause. It's not one person problem. Maybe your auntie or uncle, they are there. And, you know, who knows who has been wounded? Maybe your mom or something. So I negotiate with them, and later on, you know, we come to understanding and we go on to the work.
And how old were you at that point?
That point, I was around 14 years of age. And yes, at 14.
Were you ever severely ill or wounded during this time?
One time I was really very sick with diarrhea, and that was treated because it was a result of dirty water. Because I was having naughty, because we usually have tap water, but I went to the river with a group of people. We play there all day. We drink the river water, and later on it happened that and that kind of water we have been using before, but because of the change that the United Nations put in some tap water that are very clean, so we get used to the clean water, and then later on we, you know, I used the different water and it caused me a lot of problems. But that was the main thing until when I was really sick with the yellow fever, and that was very serious, and I couldn't have any medicine until I get local made wine that's called white wine, which is a local made of sorghum, and it was very, very good to get rid of yellow fever, and I drank maybe two bottles, like these bottles here, and that got rid of the sickness, and it was very, very serious. Many people died of that.
So you were strong enough to survive?
Yes, I was strong enough to survive. And,
did you see yourself as a child still?
Giving this responsibility myself, really, despite having being responsible, I usually ask myself, who am I in the middle of this? Am I the kid? Am I the older person? What am I really? I don't know myself. It's because that the responsibility that I was taking were not meant for me. And that make it very, very hard sometimes. When I think a lot, I have to go to play soccer. One way to get rid of those thinking is to go and play soccer. And I introduce the soccer to all group of the children. In the evening, if you come out to see them, you will see them, all of them are playing until they get tired and they go and sleep. So that we get rid of this, and I was one of those people who have been instrumental in playing soccer. I used to play soccer, and I just make it as a tool of healing my thought that, and those of the war and those of the responsibility that I'm facing at the time. And when a kid died in this group of mine, I'm responsible to organize people to bury that kid. And it becomes something that I cannot really describe. Involvement in burial of someone and those children who are doing that, you can't imagine. And I have to be there for burials. I have to be there. It is my responsibility to make sure it is buried properly, and we have to honor that kid, and we have to keep the name of that kid in the record for report in the future. If it happened that we go back to Sudan, we might tell their family how it happened and where. These were things that, I was sometimes thinking of them as a big burden on me, and these were not meant for me, because in the village back then, children don't even know when somebody died. They are not near that. They were kept uninformed. But it happened that in the area that we were in Ethiopia, it is we who knows who died, and it is we who will bury that person. It was a big responsibility.
You had to grow up very quickly.
And I did. And I did. Now, you can see me here, I really grown up, and thank God that I had that experience and to deal with a lot of things that I face, and maybe that's what has changed my life to be the man I am today.
Again, we're at a finishing point on the card, so we will just pause there now.
Thank you.